Hi, Dave Emery here. This is For the Record, program number 1136, Lyme Disease and Biological Warfare, Part 2. This is being recorded on June 24th of the year 2020. Well, as the title of the program indicates, this is an analysis of Lyme disease as a biological warfare weapon. And as was the case in the first program in this series, we will be relying on information from a book called Bitten, The Secret History of Lyme Disease and Biological Weapons, authored by Chris Newby, that's K-R-I-S, last name N-E-W-B-Y. The book was published in hardcover by HarperCollins and copyright 2019. The central element in the book is the research done by Chris Newby and others dealing with a fellow named Vili Burgdorfer, that's W-I-L-L-Y, last name B-U-R-G-D-O-R-F-E-R. Vili Burgdorfer was a Schweizerdeutsch, a Swiss of Germanic extraction, of Germanic affiliation. Switzerland has German, Italian, and French populations, and Vili was from the German part of the Swiss population. Through his mentor, an employee or a member of the family that founded J.R. Geigy AG, part of the Swiss element of the IG Farben-Nazi chemical cartel during World War II, Vili Burgdorfer made his entree into what became the U.S. Biological Warfare Research Program. It was Vili Burgdorfer who has been credited with the, quote, discovery, unquote, of an organism called Borrelia burgdorferi. That is a spirochete that is officially listed as the only organism producing Lyme disease, as we will see in our section here. There are serious questions about an organism, a rickettsia, that was called by Vili Swiss agent and an adaptation of that, since elements of that appear to have cropped up in the U.S. in connection with Lyme disease. Chris Newby has termed that Swiss agent USA. Now, in our first program and information from Bitten, and by the way, I should re-emphasize a couple of points. This is a very important book, and I emphasize very, very enthusiastically and emphatically that people should get a hold of this book and share it with other people. Also, I get no money whatsoever from either this program or the book. I have no financial skin in the game, so to speak. In the first program, we took a look at Vili Burgdorfer's work for the U.S. Biological Warfare Research Program. We began by taking a look at the emphasis placed in the U.S. Biological Warfare Research Program on genetic manipulation, the genetic manipulation of disease-causing microorganisms in order to produce mutations that were not only more pathogenic but also resistant to antibiotics. Vili did a lot of work infecting ticks, fleas, and mosquitoes, and also certain types of parasitic roundworms with multiple disease organisms so that they could be used as infectious vectors for biological warfare, weapons. Vili himself engaged in some of the genetic manipulation of such organisms, and in particular he took viruses and put those in with various other forms of microorganisms into the same tick so that the viruses, by infecting the various bacterium and other organisms, would cause mutations. Obviously, in the contemporary period, the capability for producing genetically engineered pathogens is exponentially greater than it was at that point. Vili, when being interviewed by an independent filmmaker named Tim Gray, G-R-E-Y, basically responded to a question by Mr. Gray, whose sister had died from Lyme disease complications. He spoke about his work in 1952 and 1956, two papers he had published in connection with his biological warfare research. And then in response to a question by Tim Gray, Willie answered in the affirmative that, in fact, Lyme disease could certainly be used for biological warfare purposes, and apparently the research that he had done had been applied in just exactly that fashion. Later, Chris Newby, in a 2013 interview, spoke with Willie about his work for a naval research laboratory in Cairo, in which, among other things, he was basically loading plague into fleas. Research, he said, of the type that, quote, the Nazis used to do, unquote. Willie also was doing research with something called Colorado tick fever, which masked the antigen. In other words, it basically made it difficult, if not impossible, for someone to test for a different organism if, in fact, the Colorado tick fever virus was present in that person's system. Again, the possibility of loading ticks with multiple organisms, sort of one-stop shopping cross-vectoring, to coin the term, is something to be considered. Now, in our last program, we took a look at the apparent presence of Swiss agent in Lyme disease research, and in fact, the tests that showed up, in fact, this Swiss agent, a rickettsia, similar to rickettsia, the rickettsia that causes Rocky Mountain spotted fever, the Swiss agent rickettsia was present in many of the Lyme patients. We are going to purposefully overlap the research that we are doing with the material in our last program. Now, of the Swiss agent and Willy Burgdorfer's discussion of that and Chris Newby's analysis of that, note here that Chris Newby was interviewing Willy Burgdorfer and that the Lyme disease discovery files were missing from the National Archives. Note also that where one would have expected there to be photographs of slides with the Lyme spirochete in the National Archive files. Instead, there were pictures of slides with the Swiss agent. And we will begin with that discussion. From Bitten, The Secret History of Lyme Disease and Biological Weapons by Chris Newby. I would engage the scientific part of Willie's brain in answering my two questions. One, why the Lyme disease discovery files were missing from the National Archives, and two, why images of the organism labeled Swiss agent, unquote, were located in the archive folders in the time frame where one would expect the Lyme disease spirochete pictures to be. Could this mysterious Swiss agent, which was never mentioned in any publications associated with the Lyme outbreak, also be a biological weapon? After a few warm-up questions, I started asking specifics about the ticks and the patient blood samples collected around the time of the discovery of Lyme. Vinnie told me that in late 1979, he had tested, quote, over 100 ticks, unquote, from Shelter Island, located about 20 miles from the Lyme outbreak, and all but two of those 100 ticks had an unidentified rickettsial species inside. It looked like Rickettsia montana, now called Rickettsia montanensis under a microscope, a non-disease, as we'll see, it should be allegedly non-disease-causing cousin of the deadly Rickettsia rickettsii that causes Rocky Mountain spotted fever, but this was a different species. Feeley said that a similar rickettsia had also been found in the lone star ticks, and that there was quite a bit of excitement, unquote, over that discovery. Lone star ticks are a very aggressive, virulent type of tick that was also the focal point of biological warfare research, and a fellow whom we'll hear about briefly, Daniel Sonnenschein, had done work with lone star ticks. I kept asking Willie about the mystery rickettsia, but his answers were garbled, and all I could glean from him was that he had stopped investigating it for reasons unknown. "You say they're not looking for it anymore?" I asked. "They probably paid people off," he said. "There are folks up there who have a way to enable that," unquote. Next, I showed Willie an unlabeled image of a microbe and asked him what it was. "That is a Swiss agent," said Willie. I asked him a series of questions on this microbe, and he recited what seemed like well-rehearsed lines. "The Swiss agent is a Rickettsia montana-like organism found in the European sheep tick Ixodes ricinus, and it doesn't cause disease in humans." Then I asked him why he brought samples of it from Switzerland back to his lab. He replied with a response that he often used when he seemed to know the answer, but was not going to divulge it. Quote, question mark, unquote. And still more about the Swiss agent USA and its gradual disappearance from the documentation and discussion and analysis of Lyme disease. Bear in mind, again, that Willy Bergdorfer, a career biological warfare researcher, was credited with discovering the Borrelia burgdorferi. That is one of the organisms that causes Lyme disease. It appears from the discussion here that, in addition to that, the Swiss agent USA rickettsia also plays a role, perhaps again cross-vectoring. Returning to Bitten, The Secret History of Lyme Disease and Biological Weapons by Chris Newby. For 2 days, we dug through boxes of Willie's lab notebook slides, research report, and a tattered brown file folder labeled Dietrich, 1954 to 1956, unquote. The folder was stuffed with faded carbon copies of letters documenting Willie's bioweapons work infecting fleas, mosquitoes, and ticks with lethal agents. There were reports on his plague-laden flea experiments, and they confirmed what Willie had told me in our last 2013 interview. Letters and reports detail his efforts to infect mosquitoes to deliver lethal doses of the Trinidad agent, unquote, a deadly strain of yellow fever virus extracted from the liver of a deceased person. Lindorf, someone who was assisting Chris Newby, Lindorf had also found some deposit slips from 2 different Swiss bank accounts tucked into a stack of unrelated documents. The real smoking gun, though, was Willie's handwritten lab notes on the patient blood tests from the disease outbreak in Connecticut. These tests showed the proof of presence of what I named Swiss Agent USA, the mystery rickettsia present in most of the patients from the original Lyme outbreak, a fact that was never disclosed in journal articles. It didn't take a PhD in microbiology to see that almost all the patient blood had reacted strongly to an antigen test for a European rickettsia that Willie had called the Swiss agent. Even more surprising, all this work was done in 1978, about 2 years before Willie, the lead author, published the article reporting that a spirochete was the only cause of Lyme disease. And still more from Bitten about the Swiss agent. On January 3rd, 1980, Willie wrote to Swiss professor André Eschermann about testing he'd done on the Lyme arthritis patients. By the way, that was the initial name given to what we now call Lyme disease. one more time. On January 3rd, 1980, Willie wrote to Swiss professor André Eschleman about testing he'd done on the Lyme arthritis patients. Quote, I have done some preliminary serology with sera from patients and have found very strong reactions against the Swiss agent, unquote. In February, his phone log read, Spear patient sera tested again. Still very positive for Swiss agent. In March, he wrote to Anderson and Spear again. Most specimens, with a few exceptions, reacted only against antigens prepared from the Swiss agent, unquote. In short, the disease clusters in Connecticut and Long Island seem to have been caused by Swiss agent USA. Then, in April, the Swiss agent USA rickettsia vanished. It was never again mentioned in talks, letters, interviews, or journal articles. There is, without a doubt, something suspicious about the sudden disappearance of the Swiss agent USA from all correspondence. None of the living researchers involved in the Swiss agent discovery seem to recall or know why exactly it fell off the radar. Its absence from the scientific literature is equivalent to the missing 18 and a half minutes from Nixon's White House tapes. And it leaves us with the very important question, why? And more about the Swiss agent and Chris Newby's investigation and some of the time frame against which the discovery and analysis of Swiss agent and then the disappearance of that from the literature should be weighed. Ms. Newby writes, toward the end of my investigation, I re-examined the history of Lyme disease through the eyes of an arson investigator standing knee-deep in the ashes of the bioweapon program. The first thing I noticed was that the outbreak began earlier than most people realized in the late 1960s when the military was conducting many open-air tests of aerosolized bacteria and aggressive Lone Star ticks. Willie's investigation of Lyme was interrupted by his Swiss tick-collecting trip in 1978, and upon his return, he began analyzing Jorge Benach's Long Island ticks. Jorge Benach was a Cuban-American researcher who was called in to examine ticks that appeared to be causing a disease on Long Island near where then New York Governor Hugh Carey was purchasing property. More about the investigation of the ticks that were sent up really by Jorge Benach. That's when Willie recognized that there was something different about the rickettsias he was seeing. Under a microscope, they looked like spotted fever rickettsias, but they didn't show up on the standard tests, and they didn't always cause the expected pinprick rashes. These rickettsias caused a spot-free spotted fever. Why did Willie go on the National Institutes of Health-funded Swiss sabbatical in the middle of the U.S. rickettsial outbreak? And why did the newly discovered Long Island rickettsia test positive to the European Swiss agent tests? Answer, unknown. Based on his letters to Alan Spear, Benach, and others in 1979, Willie seemed convinced that a new rickettsia could be a causative agent of Lyme disease. The possibility was reflected in a project report from the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases, or NIAID, for the period ending September 30th, 1979. Quote, only R. rickettsii has thus far been etiologically associated with human illness. That, again, is the rickettsia that produces Rocky Mountain spotted fever, beginning again. Only R. rickettsii has thus far been etiologically associated with human illness, and indications are that the other three are avirulent for man as well as for experimental animals, although tantalizing evidence based on serologic responses in residents from Long Island and California suggests that inapparent or missed infection may sometimes occur, unquote. There was nothing in the official NIH progress reports of 1979 and 1980 about the Long Island and Connecticut blood samples testing positive for European Swiss agent antigens. And in the 1979 report, Willie wrote, quote, the Swiss agent is pathogenic to meadow voles, chick embryos, and several lines of tissue culture cells, but not for guinea pigs, unquote, a finding that contradicted later claims that the Swiss agent was harmless. And what I would note is that the disappearance of Swiss agent from discussion about Lyme disease occurred at about the time that Willie had a series of phone calls with some members of the Armed Forces Epidemiological Board, and that whether or not someone told him that, you know, hey, basically, pack it in, pal, because this is classified, is a matter of speculation. But again, the disappearance of Swiss agent from the discussion and analysis of Lyme disease corresponds with conversations Willie had with the Rickettsial Commission of the Armed Forces Epidemiological Board. From Bitten by Chris Newby. It was in the beginning of 1980, 2 years before the first Lyme spirochetes were found, that the Swiss agent USA disappeared. This about-face coincided with a series of discussions Willie had with old bioweapons developers on the Rickettsial Commission of the Armed Forces Epidemiological Board, as recorded in his personal phone log. These scientists were most certainly familiar with the secret history of incapacitating rickettsial and viral agent testing, and they may have discussed with Willie the possibility of there having been an undisclosed field test in the Long Island region. Willie's on-the-record timeline of the Lyme spirochete discovery did not start until October of 1981, when Jorge Benach, who also has a CD involved with apparent biological warfare research, we'll talk about that perhaps in our next program. One more time. His on-the-record timeline of the Lyme spirochete discovery did not start until October of 1981, when Jorge Benach sent a new batch of Shelter Island deer ticks to him. That is when Willie found parasitic roundworm larvae in the main body cavity of two of the ticks. They were similar to the deer worms he'd found in ticks on his 1978 trip to Switzerland, and similar to the roundworms that he, Daniel Sonnenschein, and the Naval Research Unit in Cairo had worked with for a project exploring the, quote, relatively new field of endoparasitic transmission of disease agents, unquote. In these experiments, multiple disease agents were put inside mosquito-borne roundworms, according to an NIH research report from 1961. When Willie dissected 124 more Shelter Island deer ticks, 98% had the new rickettsias in them, and only 60% carried the new spirochetes. Willie thought that either microbe might be causing Lyme disease, but for unknown reasons, this alternative theory fell into a black hole. Omitting the Swiss agent USA findings from the Lyme discovery articles represented a serious breach of scientific ethics on Willie's part. Willie was the lead researcher, and he was the one who possessed direct knowledge of the test results showing rickettsias resembling the Swiss agent. At this early stage of research, Willie should have mentioned all potential pathogens. Did Vili feel guilty about going along with a cover-up of a biological weapons release? Was he worried about violating his secrecy oath? My instincts say that he knew when and where the agents got out, but was afraid to tell me the details. And finally, was there a darker secret Willie felt guilty about? There was his claim that he had twice been questioned by the feds about missing biological agents. And so again, one wonders about the Swiss agent. The suspicion on my part is that there was co-vectoring going on, and I wonder whether perhaps the presence of Swiss agent exacerbated the effects of Borrelia burgdorferi, and we'll talk about Borrelia research and biological warfare later on in this series. We spoke about that in For the Record 585. Bear in mind, too, the research that Vili did with Colorado tick fever virus, which masks the antigen, as he said. In other words, it makes it very difficult to test for whatever it is that is making people sick. And that would be a very useful quality to have for biological warfare application, as we looked at in our first program. Now, in Bitten, Chris Newby tackles a very disturbing factor in Lyme disease treatment and also suffering, and that is the conflicts of interest that many of the top Lyme disease researchers have from a financial standpoint. There was legislation and a Supreme Court decision that made it possible for members of federal agencies and university faculties to patent and profit from various live organisms or for parts of live organisms. In addition, as we will see later, the Lyme disease treatment establishment, to coin a term, have a lot of financial skin in the game vis-a-vis Lyme disease. They were making a lot of money as consultants for helping to develop tests for and treatments for the disease. And as such, according to Chris Newby, they were actually involved in actively frustrating the interests of both patients and people attempting to treat Lyme disease. Chris Newby writes about this in Bitten. Thinking back on my research for the Lyme documentary Under Our Skin, I concluded that there was much more money at stake with Lyme disease. It was the first major new disease discovered after the Bayh-Dole Act and the Diamond versus Shacklebarty Supreme Court decision made it possible for the NIH, the CDC, and universities to patent and profit from, quote, ownership, unquote, of live organisms. When the causative organism behind Lyme disease was announced, something akin to the Oklahoma land rush of 1889 began as scientists within these institutions began furiously filing patents on the surface proteins and DNA of the Lyme spirochete, hoping to profit from future vaccines and diagnostic tests that used these markers. For example, an NIH employee who patents a bacterial surface protein used in a commercial test kit or a vaccine could receive up to $150,000 in royalty payments a year, an amount that might double his or her annual salary. All of a sudden, the institutions that were supposed to be protectors of public health became business partners with Big Pharma. The university researchers who had previously shared information on dangerous emerging diseases were now delaying publishing their findings so that they could become entrepreneur and profit from patents through their university technology transfer groups. we essentially lost our system of scientific checks and balances. And this, in turn, has undermined patient trust in the institutions that are supposed to, quote, do no harm, unquote. With Lyme disease, there's no profit incentive for proactively treating someone with a few weeks of inexpensive, off-patent antibiotics. It's the patentable vaccines and mandatory tests before treatment that bring in the steady revenues year after year. I think this, too, should give us some perspective on the development of both medicinal treatments for and vaccines preventing infection by SARS-CoV-2, the virus that causes COVID-19. We'll talk more about that when we get back to our discussion of COVID-19. In the meantime, for the records, 1130, 1131, 1132, and 1134 go into that. Now, when Chris Newby attempted to get a hold of the guidelines, basically to explore what lay behind the development of the IDSA guidelines, that is the Infectious Diseases Society of America guidelines for Lyme disease, she not only found that there was an institutionalized dismissal of Lyme disease as an infection. It was said to be psychosomatic or even neurotic. It also eventually developed that the people involved with doing consulting of that kind often profited from testifying on behalf of medical insurers who were able to save money by denying treatment, and also that as Chris Newby began to look into this, she filed a Freedom of Information Act suit, and that suit ultimately was frustrated for 5 years, and we'll cover the remarkable circumstances surrounding her suit. Eventually, she found out why her suit was being frustrated, and that again was because the people involved with setting the guidelines for treating Lyme disease, who were basically the intelligentsia, the experts, people dispensing and defining expertise with regard to Lyme disease, basically not only had a lot of economic slash financial skin in the game, but as part of that, they were actively disseminating, according to Chris Newby, disinformation about Lyme disease in order to discredit Lyme patients and physicians and journalists who questioned the group's research and motives. Note, again, the circumstances that Chris Newby experienced when she filed her Freedom of Information Act suit. She writes about this in Bitten. And again, IDSA is the Infectious Diseases Society of America. In the IDSA guidelines, chronic Lyme isn't classified as an ongoing, persistent infection. It is considered either an autoimmune syndrome, in which a body's immune system attacks itself, or a psychological condition caused by the, quote, aches and pains of daily living, unquote, or, quote, prior traumatic psychological events, unquote. These guidelines were often used by medical insurers to deny treatment, and many of its authors are paid consulting fees to testify as expert witnesses in these insurance cases. In some states, the guideline recommendations take on the force of law so that Lyme physicians who practice outside them are at risk of losing their medical licenses. This is the protesters were at a 2009 gathering. The protesters were angry because as part of a 2008 antitrust settlement brought by Connecticut Attorney General Richard Blumenthal, now a senator, the IDSA guidelines were supposed to appoint an expert panel without biases or conflicts to do a re-review of the guidelines. In the settlement press release, Blumenthal had written, quote, "My office uncovered undisclosed financial interests held by several of the most powerful IDSA panelists. The IDSA's guideline panel improperly ignored or minimized consideration of alternative medical opinion and evidence regarding chronic Lyme disease, potentially causing serious questions about whether the recommendations reflected all relevant science about the disease." In response, the IDSA leadership selected a review panel of doctors and scientists, and they determined that, quote, "no changes or revisions to the 2006 Lyme guidelines are necessary at this time," unquote. Lorraine Johnson, JBMBA, the executive officer of LymeDisease.org and a champion of the IDSA antitrust suit, maintains that the review panel was stacked with like-minded cronies of the original guidelines authors and was therefore biased. She cites the recent article by research quality expert and Stanford professor John Ioannidis, I-O-A-N-N-I-D-I-S, M-D-D-S-C, who recommends that, quote, "professional societies should consider disentangling their specialists from guidelines and disease definitions and listen to what more impartial stakeholders think about their practices," unquote. Today, in 2019, these controversial guidelines and disputed tests are still influencing Lyme patient care. People often ask me why the IDSA and the CDC would support the problematic two-tier Lyme test. During my documentary research, I tried to get an answer to this question with a Freedom of Information Act request that solicited emails between three CDC employees and the IDSA guidelines authors. For 5 years, the CDC strung me along with frivolous denials, unexplained delays, and false promises. In essence, the delays, again going on for 5 years, became an illegal, off-the-books FOIA denial. Some delays were attributed to understaffing, year-end deadlines, and CEC personnel out, or CDC personnel out for vacation. At one point, my unanswered calls were blamed on a phone dead zone, unquote, in the CDC's new Freedom of Information Act office. After the Lyme documentary Under Our Skin was released, I decided to double down on my efforts to dislodge the FOIA request. My congressperson sent several letters to the CDC. The director of the documentary wrote a letter to President Obama. The FOIA ombudsman in the Office of Government Information Services repeatedly pressured the CDC to fulfill my request. I published blog posts about my plight and enlisted the support of a number of organizations dedicated to ensuring government transparency. Finally, the CDC sent 3,000-plus Freedom of Information Act pages, and I then understood its motivation for having delayed their release. The emails revealed a disturbing picture of a non-official group of government employees and guidelines authors that had been setting the national Lyme disease research agenda without public oversight or transparency. Investigative journalist Mary Beth Pfeiffer of the Poughkeepsie Journal was given access to these emails, and on May 20th, 2013, she published an exposé on this group's abuse of power. Bottom line, the guidelines authors regularly convened in government-funded, closed-door meetings with hidden agendas that lined the pockets of academic researchers with significant commercial interests in Lyme disease tests and vaccines. A large percentage of government grants were awarded to the guideline authors and or researchers in their labs. Part of the group's stated mission, called from these Freedom of Information Act emails, was to run a covert disinformation war, unquote, and a socio-political offensive, unquote, to discredit Lyme patients, physicians, and journalists who questioned the group's research and motives. In the Freedom of Information Act obtained emails, Lyme patients and their treating physicians were called, quote, loonies, unquote, and quacks, unquote, by Lyme guidelines authors and National Institute of Health employees. I'm going to reread these last two paragraphs for emphasis. Bottom line, the guidelines authors regularly convened in government-funded, closed-door meetings with hidden agendas that lined the pockets of academic researchers with significant commercial interest in Lyme disease tests and vaccines. A large percentage of government grants were awarded to the guideline authors and or researchers in their labs. Part of the group's stated mission, called from these Freedom of Information Act emails, was to run a covert disinformation war and a socio-political offensive, unquote, to discredit Lyme patients, physicians, and journalists who questioned the group's research and motives. In the Freedom of Information Act obtained emails, Lyme patients and their treating physicians were called loonies, unquote, and, quote, quacks, unquote, by Lyme guidelines authors and National Institute of Health employees. Because my FOIA request ended up taking 5 years to process, Under Our Skin had been made and released without answering an important question. Were the government officials responsible for managing Lyme disease health policy being inappropriately influenced by outside commercial interests? Through my Freedom of Information Act request, I found that a majority of the authors of the 2006 IDSA Lyme diagnosis and treatment guidelines held direct or indirect commercial interests related to Lyme disease. By defining the disease and endorsing tests or vaccines for which they were patent holders, they and their institutions made more money. Yet now, Vili's confession had added another potential dimension to the story, another reason for the CDC to be undercounting Lyme cases. Maybe government officials knew that something else, a pathogen in addition to Borrelia, possibly a bioweapon, was causing the problems, and they wanted to keep a lid on it. Indeed, that certainly is a question that I think needs to answer. It has now emerged that in the discussion of COVID-19, we have spoken about the fact that the U.S. Army Medical Research Institute of Infectious Diseases at Fort Detrick was closed down by the CDC in early August of 2019 for multiple safety violations. It turns out, and we'll talk more about this when we get back to COVID-19, that a lot of the work in that laboratory and in Fort Detrick as a whole and in the biological warfare research program at this point in time, if not before, is done by private contractors who contract with the DOD. That not only leaves open a wide variety of possibilities about what contractor or contractors might have been doing in terms of safety violations or actually helping to get SARS-CoV-2 out of the laboratory and into God knows where, the U.S., China, or where else. But it also raises serious questions about the economic conflicts of interest that might be involved. It turns out that in early 2019, Gilead Sciences was doing research at the U.S. Army Medical Research Institute of Infectious Diseases on the remdesivir treatment for Ebola. And that began in the early part of 2019. So the whole question of economic skin in the game vis-a-vis not only the National Institute of Health, the NIAID, the IDSA, but the question of biological warfare research. If you develop a wee beastie for BW research and then release it, you could make a lot of money from treating it, too. So it raises multiple questions. And again, I think Chris Newby did a fantastic job here with her dogged research into the Lyme disease treating establishment and what certainly appears to be some significant conflicts of interest in connection with that. We're going to, for the last few minutes of our program, we're going to review some aspects of a paper that we used for the record, 585. This is available on UK Indie Media. It is a paper by Elena, E-L-E-N-A, Cook, C-O-O-K, titled History of Lyme Disease as a Bioweapon. Lyme is a biowarfare issue. And there are a number of things that Ms. Cook brings up. It turns out that many of the researchers involved with Lyme disease, not just Willy Bergdorfer, but many of the others, either already had CVs involving biological warfare research or were subsequently involved with biological warfare research. Not only Alan Steer, but some of the other, not only a fellow named Alan Barber, I should say, another early Lyme disease researcher, and the aforementioned Jorge Benach, a Cuban-American, did work for the Epidemic Intelligence Service. That is an intelligence service that was developed to help protect the U.S. against biological warfare attack. As I have mentioned in numerous programs, the difference between, quote, defensive, unquote, and, quote, offensive biological warfare research is basically just academic. If you are studying how we beasties infect human beings or animals or plants and cause disease, there is no effective difference between, quote, offensive and, quote, defensive research. By the same token, when military researchers talk about studying pandemic causing pathogens in order to prevent a future epidemic, there is no effective difference between studying how an epidemic would be caused and preventing a future epidemic. It is essentially the same research. Interestingly enough now, the Borrelia burgdorferi is a genus of microorganisms or microorganism that not only was researched for biological warfare purposes, but it specifically was a focal point of Unit 731. That was an infamous Japanese biological warfare research base, or program, I should say, in Manchuria, in China. And it was at the time the most advanced biological warfare research program in the world. And despite the fact that they produced some horrendous crimes during World War II, testing not only on Chinese civilians and prisoners of war, but U.S. POWs, not only the files, but the experts who were involved with the research were then incorporated into the U.S. Biological Warfare Research Program at the end of World War II and the beginning of the Cold War. This is in addition to the Project Paperclip scientists whom we have spoken about so often. Elena Cook talks about that. And also in the next section that we will read here, she talks about how Borrelia were especially useful for biological warfare research purposes because they could shed their outer wall. And it was that cell wall that is the target of penicillin and related drugs, so they could ward off attack by drugs and continue to produce pathology in the targeted organism. of Borrelia and their development as BW weapons by Unit 731. Elena Cook writes as follows. In history of Lyme disease as a bioweapon, Lyme is a biowarfare issue. The Borrelia genus of bacteria, which encompasses the Borrelia burgdorferi species group to which Lyme disease is attributed, was studied by the infamous World War II Japanese Biowar Unit 731, who carried out horrific experiments on prisoners in Manchuria, including dissection of live human beings. Unit 731 also worked on a number of other tick-borne pathogens. After the war, the butchers of Unit 731 were shielded from prosecution by the U.S. authorities, who wanted their expertise for the Cold War. The U.S. government also protected and recruited German Nazi bioweaponeers under the aegis of the top-secret Operation Paperclip. Borrelia were known for their ability to adopt different forms under conditions of stress such as exposure to antibiotics, shedding their outer wall, which is the target of penicillin and related drugs. They could ward off attack and continue to exist in the body. Lyme disease is not usually fatal, and it is sometimes argued that with rapidly lethal agents like smallpox and plague available, an army would have no interest in developing it. However, what is important to understand here is that incapacitating or, quote, non-lethal, unquote, bioweapons are a major part of biowarfare R&D and have been for decades. Military strategists understand that disabling an enemy's soldiers can sometimes cause more damage than killing them, as a large amount of resources are then tied up in caring for the casualties. An efficient, incapacitating weapon dispersed over a civilian population could destroy a country's economy and infrastructure without firing a shot. People would either be too sick to work or too busy looking after those who were. And next, Ms. Cook goes into the background of many of the Lyme disease researchers, including Alan Steer, and later, as we'll see, Jorge Benach, with the Epidemic Intelligence Service, basically designed to, quote, protect, unquote, the U.S. from biological warfare research. And many of them are not casting aspersions on the integrity of any given individual here, although some of them do appear to have been involved with biological warfare research. But again, bear in mind that the distinction between offensive, unquote, and defensive, unquote, research is simply academic. From the Elena Cook paper. When Polly Murray made her now famous call to the Connecticut Health Department to report the strange epidemic among children and adults in her town, her initial reception was lukewarm. However, some weeks later, she got an unexpected call from a Dr. David Snydman, capital S-N-Y-D-M-A-N, of the Epidemic Intelligence Service, who was very interested. He arranged for fellow EIS officer Dr. Alan Steer to get involved. By the time Mrs. Murray turned up for her appointment at Yale, the doctor she had expected to see had been relegated to the role of an onlooker. Alan Steer had taken charge, and his views were to shape the course of Lyme medicine for the next 30 years up till today. This paper was from 2006. More about the EIS. The EIS is an elite quasi-military unit of infectious disease experts set up in the 1950s to develop an allegedly, that's my word because again, it wasn't officially an offensive biowarfare organization. The EIS is an elite quasi-military unit of infectious disease experts set up in the 1950s to develop an allegedly offensive biowarfare capability. Officially, it was to defend against biological warfare attack on the U.S. Continuing. Despite the banning of offensive biowar in the 1970s, the crack troops of the EIS continue to exist ostensibly for non-offensive research into emerging disease, unquote, threats, a blanket phrase covering both bioweapon attacks and natural epidemics at the same time. Graduates of the EIS training program are sent in to occupy strategic positions in the U.S. health infrastructure, taking leadership at federal and state health agencies, in academia, industry, and the media. The organization also extends its influence abroad, training officers for public health agencies in Britain, France, the Netherlands, etc. A high proportion of Steer Camp line experts are involved with the EIS. Given that the EIS, the Epidemic Intelligence Service, is a small elite force, in 2001, the CDC revealed that there were less than 2,500 EIS officers in existence since the unit was first created in 1951. It seems incredible that so many of America's top infectious disease experts would devote their careers to what they themselves claim is a hard-to-catch, easily cured disease. In our next program, we will pick up with what Alema Cook spoke about. This is information that we have already discussed in For the Record 585. We also will pick up again with another paper that Alema Cook posted in 2013, going all the way back to a book published in 1944 about Japanese research with spirochetes. And apparently Borrelia is a type of spirochete. But again, notice the high degree of the large number of EIS, Epidemic Intelligence Service, personnel involved with Lyme research. And again, the EIS is officially a defensive organization, but as I have said, past a point, the distinction between, quote, offensive, unquote, and, quote, defensive, unquote, biological warfare research is academic. And we will continue with our discussion of Ms. Cook's paper and another in our next program. This, however, concludes For the Record program number 1136, Lyme Disease and Biological Warfare, Part 2. This is being recorded on June 24th of the year 2020. I'm Dave Emery. Have fun.